Chapter 3. The Mayorn Wilderness. A quote from Triamis 1, Journals and Dialogues. The bondage we are born into is the bondage we cannot see. Verily, freedom is little more than the ignorance of tyranny. Live long enough, and you will see. Men resent not the whip so much as the hand that wields it. Spring, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk, the Long Side. Birds permeate the soaring canopies, but their chorus is distant somehow, muffled, as if they sing from the bottom of a sock. The air is close, thick with the absence of breeze. An earthen reek clings to her every breath. The smell of detritus, pounded into mush by the seasons, into earth by the years, and into stone by the ages. When she looks up, she sees pinpricks of white shining through pockets of ragged green. Otherwise, there is a quality to the filtered gloom that makes the darkness palpable, viscous, as if they trudge through a fog. The pillared depths are uniformly black. The parallax of intervening trunks slowly scissors a thousand grottos into invisibility. It almost seems a game, the accumulation of hidden spaces, enough to conceal nations. Though heaped about the massive trunks and roots, the ground is soft and easy to tread. They follow a winding line between the monstrous trees, but even still they are continually climbing and descending. Often they are forced to hack their way through hanging veils of moss. It seems unthinkable that men had once taken hoe and plow to this earth. The scalpers fear the mop for good reason, she supposes, but for some reason her fears left her. It is strange the way trauma deadens curiosity. To suffer cruelty in excess is to be delivered from care. The human heart sets aside its questions when the future is too capricious. This is the irony of tribulation. To know the world would never be so bad. She fairly jumps at the sound of her name, so intent and absent is her concentration. The old wizard is beside her. Somehow he seems of a piece with their new surroundings. No different than when crossing the wild mountain heights or passing through Kilosius before that. He has spent too many years among the wild and the ruined not to resemble them. The judging eye, he begins in his curious anon eye. There is something embarrassed in his apologetic look. You will be furious when you realize how little I know.
You tell me this because you were afraid.
No, I tell you this because I truly know very little. The judging eye is a folk legend, like the Kahit, or the White Luck Warrior, notions that have been traded across too many generations to possess any clear meaning.
I can see the fear in your eyes, old man. You think me cursed.
The wizard regards her for several unblinking heartbeats.
Worry, pity.
I think you are cursed. My Mara has told herself this from the very beginning.
There is something wrong with you. There is something broken.
So she assumed hearing the same from a Commian would leave her intact, confirmed more than condemned. But for some reason tears flood her eyes, and her face rebels. She raises a hand against the gaze of the others. But I do know, a Commian hastily adds, that the judging eye involves pregnant women. My Mara gawks at him through tears. A cold hand is reached into her abdomen and scooped away all warring sensation.
Pregnant, she hears herself say. Why?
I don't know. He has flecks of dead leaf in his hair, and she squelches the urge to fuss over him. Perhaps because of the profundity of childbirth. The outside inhabits us in many ways, none so onerous as when a woman brings a new soul into the world. She sees her mother posing before a mirror, her belly broad and low with the twins, Kel and Sammy.
So what is this curse? She fairly cries at Commian. Tell me, old fool!
She rebukes herself immediately afterward, knowing that the wizard's honesty would wither as her desperation waxed. people punish desperation as much out of compassion as petty malice. Akamian gnaws his bottom lip. As far as I know, he begins with obvious and infuriating care, those with the judging eye give birth to dead children. He shrugs as if to say, see, you have nothing to fear. Cold falls through her in sheets. What? A scowl knits his brow. The judging eye is the eye of the unborn, the eye that watches from God's own vantage. A cleft is opened about their path, a runoff that delivers them to a shallow ravine. They follow the stream that gurgles along its creases. The water is clear but seems black given the gloom. Monstrous elms pillar the embankments, their roots like great fists clenched about earth. The stream has wedged the trees far enough apart for white to glare through seams in the canopy. Here and there the water's meandering course has gnawed hollows beneath various trees. The company ducks beneath those that have fallen across the ravine, trees like stone whales.
But I've had this for as long as I can remember.
Which is my point exactly, Akamian says, sounding far too much like someone taking heart in invented reasons. He frowns, an expression Maimara finds horribly endearing on his shaggy old features. But things are always tricky where the outside is concerned. Things do not happen as they happen here.
Riddles! Why do you constantly torture me with riddles?
I'm just saying that in a sense your life has already been lived. For the god, or the gods, that is.
Which means?
Nothing, he says, scowling.
Tell me what it means.
But that cool glint has sparked in his eyes. Once again her words have cut through the fat of the old wizard's patience and struck the bone of his intolerance. Nothing, Maimara. Nothing.
A blood-curdling cry. She finds herself against sloped ground, tackled in the wizard's wiry grasp. She senses the whisper of incipient sorceries. Wards strung out and around them.
Cleric is booming something incomprehensible.
She glimpses Sutadra, staggering, a shaft and fletching jutting from his cheek.
He's trying to scream, but can only cough. Again she realizes the skin-eaters are dying again.
Hold my belt! Akamian cries to her, jerking himself to a crouch. Don't let go! In the trees! Someone shouts. Galeon. Stone hags! Stone hags!
Cleric's laughter booms through the hollows. In her thirst for all things sorceress, Maimara has read much about mandate schoolmen, and more still regarding the gnosis and the famed war cants of the ancient north. She knows about the incipient wards they use to secure their person in event of surprise attacks. Even back at Akamian's collapsed tower, she had sensed them hanging about him, like faint child scribbling, marring the art of the immediate world. Now they crackle with life-preserving ugliness. Arrows pelt the wizard's wards, sparking into nothingness. She throws her gaze to and fro, trying to make sense of the surrounding madness. She hears shouts beyond those of her companions. She glimpses shadowy figures ducking along the heights to either side. Bowmen, possessing the rangy gait and mien of scalpers. The ravine has delivered them to a human ambush. Galeon and Paquus squat behind a heaped deadfall nearby. Sutadra is down. Soma she cannot see. Cleric has a sorcerous bulwark of his own. The captain stands tall at his side.
To me! Akamian cries to the others.
He is standing now, his feet braced in water and muck. And she has pulled herself beside him.
Close about me!
Other shouts, other voices, across the heights and through the gloom. Their attackers, crying out in alarm.
Gagerwick! Wicca!
She hears a broken chorus cry, one of the few Gaelish words she understands. Gerwicca. Sorcerer. Akamian has already begun his otherworldly mutter. His eyes and mouth flare white, painting the figures crowding about them in shades of blue. She senses a rush of shadows above, sees men shimming down trees. They drop to the forest floor, scramble for earthen cover. They're running, fleeing. "Stone hags!" Pakwas booms, crying out the name like a curse. Only Galien's scarred grip prevents the sword dancer from bolting after them. A thunderous crack, somewhere to the fore of their small column. She sees Cleric's silhouette against the glare of roiling fire. A sorcerer assails him. A man hangs between vaulting branches, dressed in black, his limbs like rag-bound sticks. An ethereal dragon head rears from his hands, vomits fire. She squints against sunset brilliance. A whooshing hiss returns her gaze to things more immediate. A Kamian stands rigid, his hands raised, his face a mask of grizzled skin across sunlight. He sweeps a line of blinding white across the heights of the ravine. She throws a forearm across her eyes, glimpses her shadow as it chases a circle across the ground. The compass of Noshainrau. Fire laves barked surfaces. Wood explodes into char. But where the trees on the Galeoth side of the mountains toppled, the leviathans of the mop merely groan and crack. Leaves shower across the ravine. A burning clutch of branches crashes into the creek, bursts into steam. Flutters of deeper movement catch her eye. More men fleeing. Stone hags. She looks again to the non-man. He stands unarmed before flashing breakers of fire, crying out in his mundane voice but in tongues she does not understand. "Hawk here!" he shouts in a booming laugh. "Dimu hitloi pirmilisis!" The sorcerer's mutter of his opponent continues to rise up out of space and substance. The figure still hangs above the ravine, black against swatches of sky and levels of brightening green. A Kamian is gripping her arm, as if holding her back from some ill-advised rush. Smoke blooms from nothingness, piles outward from the heart of every hollow. Within heartbeats, a pall has obscured the overmatched sorcerer. Cleric simply stands as before, both feet planted in the shining course of the stream. His laughter is strange, like a murder of crows, crying across thunder. For several moments, no one does anything more than stare and breathe. The captain climbs alone to the crest of the ravine, lifts himself onto the back of a long fallen tree, one that reaches across the gully like a collapsed temple column. A lone shaft of sunlight illuminates him, and the tattered remnants of his dress. Light hooks about the dents in his shield and armor. "Knife our bales!" he roars into the crotched depths. "Our bales!" Sarl starts cackling, hard enough to begin hacking phlegm. Lord Cossiter turns, rakes the surrounding dark with a look of preternatural fury. "I will stab out your eyes!" he bellows. "Gut your peach! I will kick vomit from your teeth!" Maimara finds herself kneeling beside Sutadra. She is not sure why. The Kyanine has curled onto his side, hissing breaths that end in grunts, holding riven hands to either side of the arrow embedded in his cheek. They have shared no words, she and this man. They have lived shoulder to elbow on the trail for weeks, and yet they have scarcely exchanged glances. How could such a thing be? How could this life dwindling beneath her be little more than scenery one moment and... "Please, please," she mumbles. "Tell me what to do." The heathen scalper fixes her in his gaze, a look of absurd urgency. He sputters something but can only speak blood. His goatee, which has become a full beard since Kilosius, is clotted with it. "Stone hags," she hears Galien say in explanation to a Kamian. "Bandits. A scalper company that preys on its own. They saw our numbers, I'm guessing. Thought we were low-hanging fruit." A wry laugh. "Aye," Pakwas says, "sorcerous fruit." Hands held out and hopeless, she stares down at the dying stranger.
"Why are you doing this?" something cries within her. "He's dying. There's nothing to be done." Why?
The judging eye opens. But have we seen the end of them? The old wizard asks. Depends, Galien replies. No one knows what they do over the winter months, where they go. They could be desperate. And she learns what it means to stare into the moral sum of a man's life.
Sutadra.
Soot, the others had called him. You can count the bruises on your heart easily enough, but numbering sins is a far trickier matter. Men are eternally forgetting for their benefit. They leave it to the world to remember, and to the outside to call them to harsh account. 100 heavens, as Protatus famously wrote, for 1,000 hells. She can see it all, intuitions bundled into the wrinkled architecture of his skin, the squint about his eyes, the cuts along his knuckles, sin and redemption, written in the language of a flawed life. The oversights, the hypocrisies, the mistakes, the accumulation of petty jealousies and innumerable small selfish acts. A wife struck on a wedding night, a son neglected for contempt of weakness, a mistress abandoned, and beneath these cankers she sees the black cancer of far greater crimes, the offences that could be neither denied nor forgiven, villages burned on fraudulent suspicions, innocents massacred. But she also sees the clear skin of heroism and sacrifice, the white of devotion, the gold of unconditional love, the gleam of loyalty in long silence, the high blue of indomitable strength. Sutadra, she realizes, is a good man broken down, a man forced time and time again to pitch his scruples against the inscalable walls of circumstance. Forced. A man who erred for the sake of mad and overwhelming expediencies. A man besieged by history. Regret. This is what drives him. This is what delivered him to the scalpers. The will to suffer for his sins. And she loves him, this mute stranger. One cannot see as much as she sees and not feel love. She loves him the way one must love someone with such a tragic past. She knows as a lover knows, or a wife. She knows he is damned. He kicks against the mud of the stream, gazes with eyes pinned to sights unseen. He makes fish mouths, and she glimpses the arrow digging into the back of his throat. A small cry escapes him, the kind you would expect from a dying child or dog. Shh, she murmurs through burning lips. She's been weeping. Paradise, she lies. Paradise awaits you. But a shadow has fallen across them, a darker gloom. The captain. She knows this without looking. Even as she turns her face up, the judging eye closes. But still she glimpses blasted back, coal-orange eyes leering from a charred face. He raises his boot and kicks the arrow down, wood popping in meat. Sutadra's body jerks, flutters like a thread in the wind. You rot where you fall, the captain says with a queer and menacing determination. My Mara cannot breathe. There is a softness in the Kyanine's passing, a sense of fire passing into powdery ash. She raises numb fingers to brush the boot print from the dead man's nose and beard, but cannot bring herself to touch the graying skin.
Weakness! The captain screams at the others. The stone hags struck because they could smell our weakness. No more! No more wallowing! No more womanish regret! This is a slog!
The slog of slogs!
Sorrel screeches out, chortling.
And I am the rule of rules, the captain grates.
Zongas altered their course, leading them away from the stone hags and their flight. They left Sutadra behind them, sprawled across the muck, the broken arrow jutting like a thumb from his swelling face. Scalpers lie where they fall, such was the rule. The cyclopean trunks were not so long in obscuring him. Citadra had always been a mystery to Akamian, and to the others, from what he could tell. Galien sometimes made a show of asking the Kyanine his opinion, then taking his silence as proof of agreement. "See?" he would crow as the others laughed. "Even Soot knows!" This was the way with some men. They sealed themselves in, bricked their ears and their mouths, and spent the remaining days speaking only with their eyes, until these too became inscrutable. Many, you could wager, held chaos in their hearts, shrill and juvenile. But since ignorance is immovable, they seem immovable, imperturbable. Such is the power of silence. For all Akamian knew, Citadra was little more than a weak-willed fool, a peevish coward behind the blind, of an impassive demeanor. But he would always remember him as strong. None of this, however, explained my Mara's reaction, her tears, her subsequent silence, after the debacle in the mines of Kilausius. He had assumed she would be immune to terror and violence. He tried to sound her out, but she simply looked away, blinking. So he paced Galien and Paquas for a time, asking about the stone hags. The bandits had haunted the mop for some 5 years now, long enough to become the scourge of the Long Side. Paquas absolutely despised them. Preying upon one's own was an outrage for the Zeumi, apparently. Galien regarded them with the same wry contempt he took to everything. "It takes figs to do what they do," he cried at one point, obviously trying to bait his towering friend. "As big and black as your own." Akamian was inclined to agree. Hunting Shrank was one thing. Hunting men who hunted Shrank was something else entirely. They told him the story of the stone hag captain, Paphorus, the Mysunsay schoolman, who had assailed Cleric. According to rumor, he was a notorious breacher, someone who failed to expedite his arcane contracts, a cardinal sin for a school of mercenaries. He had been chased into the wilds more than a decade ago. "He was the first spitter to chase the bounty," Galien explained. "Pompous, one of those fools who turns the world upside down when he finds himself at the end of the line. Arrogant unto comedy, they say he was outlawed for burning down an imperial custom house in one of the old camps." And so the stone hags were born. Scalper companies always vanished in skinny country, swallowed up as if they had never been. "It's chop, chop, chop with the skinnies," Paquas said. "Runners always die." But the stone hags invariably left survivors, and so word of their atrocities spread and multiplied. "More famous than the skin-eaters," Galien said cheerfully. "The one and only." Akamian stole several glances at Maimara over the course of their account, still puzzled by her blank face and distracted gait. Had she somehow come to know Citadra? "He died the death allotted to him," he said, resuming his place at her side. "Citadra," he added in response to her sharp look.
"Why? What makes you say that?"
Her eyes gleamed with defensive tears. The old wizard scratched his beard and swallowed, reminded himself to take care that it was my Mara he was speaking to. "I thought you mourned his loss."
"The eye," she snapped, her voice cracking about a bewildered fury. "It opened. I saw. I saw him. I saw his life."
It seemed he should have known this.
"It's his damnation I mourn," she said. "The damnation you will share," her look added.
Drusus Akamian had spent the bulk of his life knowing he was damned. Stand impotent before a fact long enough, and it will begin to seem a fancy, something to be scorned out of reflex, denied out of habit. But over the years the truth would creep upon him, steal his breath with visions of schoolmen and their thousands, shades, shrieking in endless agony. And even though he had repudiated the mandate long ago, he still found himself whispering the first of their catechisms. "Though you lose your soul, you shall gain the world." "The damnation you want me to teach you," he said, referring to the sorcery, the blasphemy she desperately wanted to learn. She ignored him after that. So damn mercurial. He fumed until he realized that days had passed since their last Gnostic lesson. Everything had seemed half-hearted after Kilauges, as if sand had been packed into the joints of all the old motions. He scarce had the stomach to teach, so he simply assumed that she scarce had the stomach to learn. But now he wondered whether there was more to her sudden disinterest. Life's harder turns had a way of overwhelming naive passions. He found himself recalling his earlier advice to Soma. She had given something, something she had yet to understand. Time. She would need time to discover who she had become, or was becoming. The captain called them to a halt in what seemed a miraculous clearing. An oak had been felled in its hoary prime, leaving a blessed hole in the otherwise unbroken canopy. The company milled about, blinking at the clear blue sky, staring at the remains of the titanic oak. The tree had crashed into the arms of its equally enormous brothers and now hung propped and skeletal above the forest floor. Much of the bark had sloughed away, so that it resembled an enormous bone braced by scaffolds of winding branches. Timbers had been set across several forks, creating three platforms at different heights.
"Welcome to Stump," Pock was said to a Commian with a curious grin. "This place is known to you." "All scalpers know this place." With a gesture, the sword dancer led him up the tree's base. A knoll rose about it, stepped and knotted with roots. The stump itself was as broad as a cast menial's hovel, but only as high as the wizard's knee. The bulk of the severed trunk loomed just beyond, rising into the confusion of the surrounding forest. "For the longest time," Pacquus explained, "the legend was that these trees were crypts, that each of them had inhaled the dead from the earth. So, several years ago, when it seemed the fringe would retreat into the deeper mop, Galen and I hacked this very tree to the ground. We worked in shifts for 3 days." The old wizard scowled in camaraderie. "I see." A jovial wink. "Look what we found."
A Kalmian saw it almost instantly, near the peak of the rough-hewn cone. At first he thought it had been carved, the product of some morbid scalper joke. But a second look told him otherwise. A skull, a human skull, embedded in the coiled heartwood. Only a partial eye socket, a cheek, and several teeth, molars to canine, had been chiseled clear. But it was undeniably human. A shudder passed through the old wizard, and it seemed he heard a voice whisper,
"The heart of a great tree does not burn."
Memories from a different age, a different trial.
"Some," Pacquus was saying, "will tell you the skinnies own the mop."
"What do you say?"
"That they're tenants, same as us." He frowned and smiled as if catching himself in the commission of some rank 3C's folly. "The dead own this land."
The oblong of bare sky quickly darkened. After a somber repast, the company spread across the three platforms built into the fallen giant, relishing in what was likely a false sense of security, even as they cursed the unforgiving edges that crooked their backs and poked their shoulders. That night was a difficult one. The surrounding darkness was every bit as impenetrable as in Kilauges, for one, and the threat of the stone hags had them on the sharp, as Sorrel might say. But the real problem, Akamian eventually decided, lay with the trees. In the wild lore of witches, these scraps that Akamian had encountered, anyway, great trees were as much living souls as they were conduits of power. 100 years to awake, the maxim went. 100 years for the spark of sentience to catch and burn, as a slow and often resentful flame. Trees begrudged the quick, the old witches believed. They hated as only the perpetually confused could hate. And when they rooted across blooded ground, their slow, creaking souls took on the shape of the souls lost. Even after 1,000 years, after innumerable punitive burnings, the 1,000 temples had been unable to stamp out the ancient practice of tree burial. Among the Ainoni, in particular, caste noble mothers buried rather than burned their children, so they might plant a gold-leafed sycamore upon the grave, and so create a place where they could sit with the presence of their lost child. Or, as the shrial priests claimed, the diabolical simulacrum of that presence. For his part, Akamian did not know what to believe. All he knew was that the Mop was no ordinary forest, and that the encircling trees were no ordinary trees. Crypts, Pakwas had called them. A legion of sounds washed through the night, sighs and sudden cracks, the endless creak and groan of innumerable limbs, the hum and whine of nocturnal insects. Eternal sounds. The longer Akamian lay sleepless, the more and more they came to resemble a language, the exchange of tidings both solemn and dire.
Listen, they seemed to murmur, and be warned. Men trod our roots, men bearing honed iron.
According to Pakwas, nightmares were common in the Mop.
You dream horrors, the towering man said,
his eyes waxy with unwelcome memories. Wild things that twist and throttle. The plains of Mengeta occurred to the old wizard, and the dreams he had suffered marching across them with the men of the Tusk. Could the Mop be a topaz, a place where trauma had worn away the hard rind of the world? Could the trackless leagues before them be soaked in hell? He had been forced to flee the first holy wars some 20 years previous, so crazed had been his nightmare slumber. What would he suffer here? Aside from his one nightmarish dream of the finding of the No-God, he had dreamed of naught but the same episode since climbing free of Kil'Augeas. The High King, Selmomus, giving Siswatha the map detailing the location of Ishwal, the birthplace of Anasarimbakelis, telling him to secure it beneath the library of Sauglish, in the coffers, no less. Keep it, old friend. Make it your deepest secret. He lay on the crude platform, his back turned to Maimara. A warmth seeped through the exhausted weight of his body. Pondering rose out of pondering, thought out of thought. He drifted ever further from the mighty trees and their conspiracies, ever further from the ways of the wakeful. And, as so often happened when he stood on the threshold of slumber, it seemed he could see, actually see, things that were no more than wisps, shreds of memory and imagination, the golden curve of the map case, the twin Umeri inscriptions, token curses common to ancient Nosarai reliquies, saying, "Doom, should you find me broken." And he thought, strange, finding knowledge in sleep. He stood shackled, one among the gloom of many, a line of captives, wrist chained to wrist, ankle to ankle, wretched for abuse, standing encased in horror and ignorance, a file running the length of a shadowy tunnel. His eyes rolled in equine panic. What now? What now? He saw walls, which for an instant seemed golden, but formed of mangled thatch, scrub and undergrowth, surging and twining to weave a black corridor about their miserable passage. He could even discern the terminus, over shoulders slouched in woe and capitulation, an opening of some kind, a clearing, bright with things he did not want to see. His teeth were missing. Beaten? Yes, beaten from his skull. No, Akamian sputtered. Awareness rising like a fog within him. The trees, he realized. Trees! Crypts, the scalpers called them. Cease! Akamian cried. But not one of the chain shadows raised their heads in acknowledgement. Cease! He raged. Cease, or I shall burn you and your kin. I will make candles of your crowns, cut trails of ash black through your heart. and somehow he knew that he screamed with the wrong lips in the wrong world. Gagging shrieks filtered down the hall, ringing as though across iron shields. Something blared, a sound too engulfing, too guttural to be a mere horn. Without warning, the chains yanked him in a shadowy procession forward, one stumbling step toward the light. The clearing. And though all the world's terror loomed before him, the brutalized stranger thought, "Please, let this be the end." Akamian found himself sitting, gripping his bony shoulders with bony fingers. His ears roared, and the blackness spun. He panted, gathering his wits and wind. Only then did the other sounds of the night creep into his hearing. The distant howl of wolves, the creak of sentience through vaulting limbs, the sound of Pakwas in his gentle snore, Sorrel's mumbling growl, and someone wailing without breath on the platform below him.
"No,"
he heard a hitching, glutinous voice murmur in Gaulish.
"Please!"
Then again hissed through clenched teeth against returning waves of terror.
"Please!"
Hammeron, he realized, the most broken by Kilauges. There was a time when Akamian had thought himself weak, when he had looked on men such as these scalpers with a kind of complicated envy. But life had continued to heap adversity upon him, and he had continued to survive, to overcome. He was every bit the man he had been, too inclined to obsess, too ready to shoulder the burden of trivial sins. But he no longer saw these ingrown habits as weaknesses. To think, he now knew, was not a failure to act. Some souls wax in the face of horror, others shrink, cringe, bolt for an easy life in its many cages, and some, like young Hammeron, find themselves trapped between inability and the inevitable. All men cry in the dark, those who did not were something less than men, something dangerous. Pity welled through the old wizard, pity for a boy who had found himself stranded on scarps too steep to climb. Pity and guilt. Akamian heard the whine and scuff of someone on the platform above him. He blinked against the dark. The limbs of the fallen tree forked black across the stars. The nail of heaven glittered above, higher on the horizon than he had ever seen it before, with his waking eyes at least. The clearing lay bare and silent about them, a swatch of wolves soaked in the absolute ink of shadows at night. Maimara lay curled at his side, as beautiful as porcelain in the bluing light. The platform above him, a ragged rectangle shot with strings of luminance between the timbers. The figure who climbed down from its edge looked like a wraith. His clothing was so shredded about the edges. Starlight rippled across the unrusted splints of his hauberk. The captain, Akamian realized with dim horror. The figure shimmed along the trunk, black sheets of hair swaying. He had scarcely set foot on the corner of Akamian's platform before swinging down to the next, as nimble as a monkey. The two men regarded each other for scarce a heartbeat, but it was enough. Ravenous was all Akamian could think. There was something starved about the eyes that glared from the disgusted squint, something famished about the grin that cut the plaited beard. The man dropped out of sight. Still staring at the point where their eyes had connected, Akamian heard him land on the platform below, heard the knife whisk from the sheath.
"Sopper!"
a voice hissed. There were three thuds in quick succession, each carrying the dread timber of flesh. Gasping, the choking rattle of pierced lungs, the sound of a heel scraping across barked wood, a feeble kicking. Then nothing. A poisonous fog seemed to fill the wizard, steaming out from his gut into his extremities, something that at once burned and chilled. Without thinking, he lay back beside Maimara, closed his eyes in the pretense of sleep. The noise of Lord Cossiter climbing back to his platform seemed scabrous thunder in his ears. It was all Commian could do not to raise warding hands against the sound. For several moments he simply breathed against the fact of what had happened, against the absence of the life that had been weeping below him only moments before. He had sat immobile and listened to it happen. Then he had pretended to sleep. He had sat there and watched a boy murdered in the name of his lie. The lie of a wizard who made Benjuka pieces out of men. The obsession. Strength, Akamian told himself. This is what fate demands of you. If his heart had not hardened to flint, he knew it would before this journey was done. You could not kill so many and still care. Fail or succeed, he would become something less than a man. Something dangerous. Like the captain. Nothing was said about the dead man in the morning. Not even Maimara dared speak, either because the atrocity was too obvious or too near. They simply gnawed and stared off in random directions while Hammerin's blood dried to a rind along the bottom of his platform's timbers. Even Sarl seemed loath to breach the silence. If any looks were exchanged, Akamian found Lord Cossiter's presence too oppressive to watch for them. The fact that nothing was said about anything, including the stone hags and their attack, said everything. The captain's new-found faith in the rules did not sit well with his men. The company resumed its march through the deep forest gloom, somehow more desolate, more lost and exposed, for the absence of just two souls. Once again they struck at a tangent to the mountains, down, so that walking at once seemed easier and harder on the knees. They skirted the banks of the swift-flowing tributary for a time, eventually crossing where it panned across boulder-chalked shallows. The elms and oaks, if anything, were even more gigantic. They threaded a makeshift path between the trunks, some of them so immense and hoary they seemed more natural formations than trees. All their lowermost limbs were dead, shorn of bark, radial tiers stacked upon radial tiers, creating a false skeletal canopy beneath the canopy proper. Whenever Akamian glanced up at them, they resembled black veins, networks of them, wending and forking across higher screens of sun-glowing green. As the day wore on, the gaps between the walkers seemed to expand. This was when Paquas and Galian, doing their best to shun Somin Dutta, happened to find themselves abreast Akamian and Maimara. They walked in guarded silence for a time. Paquas softly hummed some tune from his native Zeum, Akamian decided, given its strange intonations. "At this rate," Galian finally ventured, "it'll be just him sitting on a pile of bones by the time the skinnies get to us." The Nancer spoke without looking at anyone. "Aye," Paquas agreed. "Our bones." They were not so much searching for an understanding, it seemed, as they were acknowledging one that already existed. If anything proves that men are bred for intrigue, it is the way conspiracies require no words. "He's gone mad," Commian said. Maimara laughed, a sound the old wizard found shocking. Ever since the stone hags and their abortive ambush, she had seemed bent on silent brooding. "Gone mad, you say?" "No one survived more slogs," Galian said. "Yes," Paquas snorted. "But then no one has a pet non-man, either." "Things are topsy out here," Galian replied. "You know that. Crazy is sane. Sane is crazy." The former Nancer columnary fixed his canny gaze on Akamian. "So, what do we do?" Akamian asked. Galian's eyes roamed the surrounding gloom, then clicked back. "You tell me, wizard." There was anger in his tone. A resolution to voice hard questions. Akamian found his gaze as piercing as it was troubling, a fellow soldier's demand for honesty.
What are the chances a company this small will make your precious coffers, eh?
This was when Akamian realized that he stood against these men. Mad or not, Lord Cossiter showed no signs of wavering. If anything, his most recent acts of madness displayed a renewed resolve, as much as Akamian hated to admit it. Hammerin had been a liability. The old wizard found himself warding away thoughts of Kellis and his ability to sacrifice innocence. "We've scarce reached the fringe," Paquas exclaimed, "and we're three-quarters dead." The fringe, the wizard recalled, was what scalpers called the boundary of Shrank country.
"As I said," Galien replied, "at this rate." "Once we clear the Maeorn wilderness," Akamian declared, with as much certitude as he could muster, "we'll be marching in the wake of the great ordeal. Our way will be cleared for us."
"And the coffers?" Galien asked with a kind of sly intensity, one that the old wizard did not like.
"They are as you say?"
Akamian could feel my Mara watching his profile. He could only pray her look was not too revealing.
"You will return princes."
Cleric was the first to hear the cries. The sound was distant, small, like the wheeze at the bottom of an old man's breath. They had to look to one another to be sure the others had heard it. The land was rutted with wandering slopes and gullies, yet no matter how steep the grade, the canopy remained unbroken above them, and nothing save a dim shower of gold and green filtered to the forest floor. This made determining the distance, let alone the direction of the cries, all but impossible. Then they heard a crack of thunder, too unnatural to be anything other than sorcerous. The scalpers all looked to Cleric, a reflex born of previous slogs, Akamian imagined. "The mop," the non-man said, raking the surrounding gloom with his gaze. "The trees play games with sounds, a blink belonging to things nocturnal. With us."
"Then we need to be free of them," Akamian said. With scarce a look at the captain, he began intoning the inconceivable and dug fingers of spoken meaning into the soft muck of the world. Heedless of the wondering looks, he trod into the open air. He climbed through the lower regions of the canopy, using his hands to pull himself around the dead limbs blocking his sorcerous ascent. Vertigo tipped his stomach. Even after so many years, so many cants, his body still resented the impossibility. He threw his forearms across his face to fend lashing branches as he approached the greenery. He found himself fighting, embroiled in nets of foliage. Then the veils fell away. Pointed wind, naked sunlight. He blinked against the brightness, savored the daub of sun across his rutted cheeks. He could scarce step above the crowns, so immense were the trees. He found himself walking around in between the stacked heights to gain a better view. On and on, as far as his old eyes could see, mighty shags of leaves, heaped and hanging, fluttering pale silver in the breeze, all the way to the horizon. Were it not for the way the leafy surface followed the summits and troughs of the underlying land, he would have likened what he saw to the slow tossing surface of a sea. The cries were clearer, but their direction escaped him until he glimpsed the flash of sorcery in the corner of his eye. To the north, a scarp of bald stone rose against the distance, rising and falling so as to resemble a young woman slumbering on her side. He mouthed the quick cant of scrying, and the air before him became watery with distorted images. Then he glimpsed them. Men, scalpers, running through the foliage along the plummet's edge. They ran as fleet as children, a scattered file of them, flashing between screens of leaves and mighty trunks, in and out of shadow. A stand of strangler oaks dominated the waste of the escarpment, monsters who clenched the living rock of the edge and sent skeins of roots, interlocking fans of them, roping down the cliff face. This was where the scalpers clustered, throwing panicked glances back the way they had come. Several had already begun their perilous descent. A second party of scalpers abruptly appeared on the edge,
farther back, high on the hip. Akamian had assumed the company was being chased along the ledge, but now he realized they fled the forest deeps behind them, that they were running toward the skin-eaters. The men hesitated for a moment, their mouths shouting holes in their beards. Whatever pursued them, Akamian realized, was close, too close for them to join their comrades among the oaks. Numb and blinking, he watched them begin leaping, tiny human figures dropping along sheer stone faces, vanishing into the canopies below. It seemed he could feel the plummet of each tingling through his gut. Then they appeared, rising from the gloom, engulfing those who had elected to stand and fight. Shrank, raving multitudes of them. Shrieking white faces, a cacophony of miniature cries, human and inhuman, threaded the air. Men hacked at the white-skinned rush, stumbling, falling. One wild-haired scalper, obviously a Thunieri, stood on a raised thumb of stone, wielding a great axe in each hand. He cut and hammered the first wave to ruin, managed to cow a second before black shafts began jutting from his unarmored extremities. A stagger, then a misstep sent him skidding and jerking down the cliffside. A kind of breathless remorse struck the old wizard. This was how scalpers died, he realized. Lost, thrown over the edge of civilization. A crazed death, not simply violent. Unwitnessed, unmourned. The scalpers down among the strangler oaks seemed to be making good their escape. A dozen of them were now clinging to hanging skirts of roots, daring a breakneck descent. More fugitives crowded the lip, tossing what gear they still carried below. Then one of them simply stepped out over the ledge and continued walking, as though he wobbled and almost fell. The Mysunsay schoolman, Akamian realized. Paphorus, too high to use the ground, the fool was trying to negotiate the arcane echo of a promontory that jutted outward about half the height of the cliffs proper. Even from this distance, his mark was clear. The stone hags. He was watching the very men who tried to murder them, watching them die. Akamian could see the shrank high on the scarp's hip, exulting in the flesh of those they had overcome. Others raced toward the remaining scalpers on the waste below, individuals dog-loping along the ledge, masses surging through the parallel deeps. Helpless, Akamian watched more suicidal leaps and another round of desperate, hopeless battles. Then, with several stalwarts still roaring and battling, the floating Mysunsay set the cliff ledge alight. Even from such a distance his sorcerous cry tickled the edges that could not be seen. A great horned head rose before the Mysunsay's slight figure, real enough for sunlight to glint from black scales, yet stamped in smoke all the same. The dragon head, the dread mainstay of anagogic sorcery. Golden fire spewed out over the bristling ledge, washed into the avenues between the great trees, making burning shadows of shrank and men alike. A chorus of screams climbed across the bowl of the sky. The scalpers hanging from the roots below raised arms against the shower of burning debris. The dragon head dipped again, and more fire washed across the carpets of smoking dead. The shrank retreated, howling and screaming, vanished into the safety of the deeper forest. There was a blinking pause. The Mysunsay struggled with his arcane footing, seemed to stumble, then simply dropped. Akamian hung in indecision. Gone were the shouts, the cries. Fires smoldered along the length of the scarp's waist, trailing long plumes of black smoke. Miles of canopy swayed and rebounded in the open wind. We should return. The old wizard fairly soiled his wolfskin robes, such was his shock. He whirled. Cleric hung in the air a mere span behind him, yet the old wizard had heard nothing, sensed nothing. "Who?" he cried before his wits returned to him. "Who are you?"
A Mysunsai schoolman keeping company with scalpers seemed mad enough. But a non-man? A Kuya mage?
The Shank, they move in force, the ageless Ishroy said, his face white and immaculate in the high sun. The mop swayed and tossed to the horizon behind him.
The others must be warned.